Welcome to Iteration, a weekly podcast about programming, development, and design through the lens of amazing books, chapter by chapter. I am joined this week, as always, by the wonderful JP. Oh, and my name is John, by the way. Hi, JP.
How's it going, man?
It's going really good. I'm excited. We are doing another kind of micro book before we move into a really big, meaty one. And we'll move into that in a second. We'll move into kind of talking through what book we're doing and kind of updating those things. But first, what is new with you, JP? We actually didn't record last week because we've both been so freaking swamped. So tell me a little about what's been going on.
Yeah, don't you just love talking about how busy you are?
I don't. I would love to brag about how I have nothing to do. To me, that's like the ultimate brag, is that I did nothing last week. And I wish maybe at some point in my life, I'll be able to be that zen-like that I can brag that I just did nothing.
Yeah, so we have both been very busy on my end. And it's great that I could finally talk about this. So Open Listings got acquired by Opendoor, which has been like a huge deal in the real estate industry. And like, who would have ever thought that getting your company being acquired would be very time consuming as like an engineer? But there's just a lot of like meetings about like how we're going to integrate and like what our new goals are going to be and like what things are going to look like. And there's a lot of onboarding that has to happen. And life has just been very insanely busy.
That's interesting. Did the pace at Open Listings slow down at all in this kind of merging process and onboarding, or are you expected to kind of ship features just the same?
The pace has always been, you know, the pace hasn't changed much. It's more so that there's like a ton of meetings now. I don't want to say that right. There's like meetings every day, but like there's a lot of, I don't know, there's just a lot of meetings recently that just make it feel like, oh man, when am I going to have time to do actual work, which I think is like a normal
Well, that's
thing.
What I'm saying. So did they not necessarily slow the velocity, or maybe they didn't foresee the kind of merging of the two organizations being like time consuming for the individual devs?
I don't know how to answer that, actually.
No, that's fair enough. And sometimes there's just more logistics involved than anyone realizes. So that's interesting. Does your actual day-to-day job, is it going to change to your knowledge, or is it pretty much staying the same and within Open Listings?
For the most part, we're going to operate like business as usual. I don't know. A lot of things are just in flux right now because like we're in a temporary office space. We're going to be moving to another office, and like on top of like having to move to like a WeWork very temporarily, getting acquired, merging, meeting a bunch of Opendoor people. Everything has just been like in a constant state of flux. And so like, it feels like sometimes there's days where I just like, wow, it's already 4 o'clock. What the heck happened to the whole day?
Oof. Yeah.
But in exciting news, I'm going to be in San Francisco for the first week of October. We're like stopping everything. We're stopping all of our sprints, and we're going to do like a company-wide hackathon. I don't know if I'm supposed to be, if I'm like allowed to talk about this stuff. I don't see why not. I don't know why that would be like a secret or anything. But now I'm just like more cognizant of like, should I be talking about this? Maybe not. Anyways, we're doing like a company-wide hackathon that it's not like a week of wasted time, because what you work on is like what's not like budgeted for in the sprint, but like what can still contribute to like the product. Like it's not just like, oh, we're going to spend a week and hack on like a chess application or something. Okay. I don't know, like an Asana clone. It's like, what can we do that maybe we have been pushing off, or we don't budget like sprint planning for, but can like possibly still be beneficial for
users.
That's
so interesting. So it's kind of like, you know, it's a hackathon, but it's within the scope of the product. And it's like, no bad ideas, just kind of throw shit at the wall for the week and see what you can hack together and kind of demo. Is that kind of what the idea is? Do you pair up with people, or is it kind of self-directed?
Yeah, so there's like a huge spreadsheet, and you could like join any team you want. But I think for this one, since like Open Listings is very new to the Opendoor family, the team I'm going to be working on is mostly just going to be like a couple of my like Open Listings coworkers. Oh. So we have like three engineers and a designer, and we're going to try to like make a mobile app, I think, which is going to be pretty fun.
Ooh, really? So you're going to have a week to possibly hack on a mobile app. That's super cool.
Yeah, super excited. Our Airbnb looks really cool.
Yeah, you sent me a link. It looks totally awesome. That's great, man. That's super cool. I'm excited for you. And that should be like a good divergent? Diverge? I don't know what the word is. Diversion. Ha, there it is. Yeah, diversion from like the day-to-day pace that you've been at, because it's been pretty frenetic and you've been pushing a lot of features, writing a lot of code. So yeah, things have been pretty busy for me too. Just my agency continues to grow, which is super exciting. Been doing tons of interviews, hopefully getting an answer back from a candidate soon that I'm hopefully hiring. So hopefully that goes well. But on top of that, like just totally drowning in client work. And so there's this dichotomy of needing to grow the team and invest time into growing the team. But at the very moment that I'm most overwhelmed, like as an agency with work to spit out. So it's this like double-edged sword of needing to invest in resources and building the team, but also continuing needing to get things out the door. And just the longer I wait to stop and hire, the more the backlogs grow for all the client work. But it's been good. And I have some very promising candidates. I'm super excited. Hopefully I have something to share soon and some answers I get back soon.
What's that cliche saying? It's like, it's a good problem to have.
Oh, such a good problem to have. I'm super excited for some of these new clients and projects I have. I'm just like absolutely ecstatic to be digging into them. Just even today, I was just doing some like general domain design for an upcoming project, and I'm just super excited. A lot of Rails stuff, a little bit of React Native, which is good, and I'm getting better at it. Speaking of, I actually shipped. I shipped on my own a like significant React Native feature today. So I've like kind of changed copy and navigation and routing here and there, but I've never actually owned a feature start to finish in React Native. And it's on the Play Store working in React Native. So that's exciting.
Can you like talk about like what that looked like? Like what kind of components were you working with? Like what was the feature? Was it like hard to do that as someone who's like never shipped a React Native feature?
It definitely was, especially because I've never taken the time to really learn React Native. I've done a couple tutorials for React in general, but the paradigms don't exactly carry over, as you probably know definitely better than me. So just for the record, JP is a JavaScript wizard, much better at React Native and React stacks than I ever am. I'm more on the Rails side is where I live. Anyway, so the feature, let's start there. So the application that I'm building uses a token login system. So it's one of those things where you enter your phone number, hit send code, and then you confirm that code. So the request from the client was that login and token system supports email or SMS. So the entry screen says enter your email or phone number. And so it has to handle all of that routing accordingly. And there was a lot in the application that was phone specific. So I kind of cheated because I didn't actually build components from scratch to implement this feature, but I totally had to rewrite existing features in a way that was a lot deeper than I've ever had to do before, including rewiring all the URLs of where that token's getting requested, redoing all the validation for the inputs, whether it's an email or a phone number. So there was a lot of revisions needed and just deep revision to how the authentication routing was handled and how the request is sent and gets sent back. And I'm just proud that I was able to power through all that and get it all shipped. Because I had a contractor was slated to be working on it today and shipping that feature, and it was due today. So it was like totally down to the wire, and that contractor just dropped the ball. So I'm like, well, shit, okay, I guess I'm shipping a major feature in React Native. Here we go.
Was this the Yuvo Health app?
Yeah, it was, yeah.
Oh, cool, cool, cool. Dang, so you got to touch a lot of that fun React navigation and like Redux user authentication stuff that's living on there. That's kind of fun.
Yeah, it was. And what I ended up doing is because I knew I would struggle because I'm touching a lot of pieces and there was a lot to change. So what I ended up doing is just creating a branch that was just called like trash and just getting as far as I could and like just trying things out. So kind of like we've talked about in past, like kind of tracer code, kind of prototyping. But when I finally like got it kind of wired together and working, then I created a new branch. And actually the actual branch that I deployed is my third pass at it.
Oh, dang.
Yeah. So it took me quite a while to like get it out the door and get it live, but I learned a lot in the process and I'm a lot less intimidated in general, especially with the routing and the way the whole, you know, URL, the AJAX requests are sent back in the whole system. at least the post and, you know, return, the way it handle interacts with the API. Because in the past, I've definitely edited some screens, but I've more focused on the styling of things, you know, changing some colors and fonts, rewording things, kept it like very, very simple without really touching logic of anything. And so this is the first like pretty deep React Native logic change that I did. And it was successful, so that's good.
Yeah, that's super fun. I like live in those moments of like, it's almost painful because you don't know what you're doing, kind of a thing. You like really stretch yourself to like understand what's going on. I don't know. I think those are like the best learning moments, because like if it's not painful, it's like you're not learning anything, kind of a thing. And so I think that's like kind of fun to like struggle through something and get something working. It's like the most gratifying thing when you've been struggling for like days on end and then you finally get it working and then you have that like aha moment. When you're like, oh, this wasn't so hard. I can't believe it took me this long.
Yeah, but there's this middle ground though, because like if you think of it like weightlifting, you know, because you know I'm in the gym all the time. No, but if you think of it like weightlifting, like learning something difficult for the first time, like if you try to jump into React Native without really understanding JavaScript or understanding it, like you'll be trying to bench press 400 pounds and you just get nowhere and you get frustrated and you in fact kind of hurt yourself. Like you go backwards. And it's sometimes hard with new frameworks or new languages to find the right amount of weight to try to lift off the bat, because you do want to strain and push it hard. But even if I tried to do this a month ago, I don't think I would have been able to like get that weight up, and it just would have been frustrating. And sometimes it's even more counterproductive. So I couldn't agree more that like to learn, you have to push yourself and really strain. But there's like, it's that fine line. And then as the novice, you don't know how much you can take either, because it's not weight. And so it's that really hard line to try to walk. And I feel like React Native is something, because there's, especially deploying to both Android and iOS, there's just so many different pieces within the Android Development Studio and Xcode and all those things, that there's just so many places and layers to get your head around. It's really tough to lift that weight up, man.
Yeah, you need like as many quick wins as you can possibly get, and then like keep building on little small wins. I mean, that's easier said than done, obviously, but like sometimes when you're like in that black hole of like, I've not been productive for the last 12 hours, I don't know what I'm doing, that can be like such a painful experience to have.
Yeah, absolutely. But what's nice is when you learn things under those conditions, you rarely forget them. So yeah, that is kind of nice. Those lessons really stick.
So except when it's WebRTC, and then you forget everything.
That's right. You forget it all really easily. So cool. It's awesome to get some updates of where things are at. I'm going to jump into the book. So the book that we're going to be covering over the next two or three episodes, might be four episodes, we'll kind of see how this arc kind of lasts, probably somewhere between two and three episodes, is a short read. It's a PDF read, kind of like the last one did that we did. It's by, how do I say this name, JP? Bail me out.
I think it's Avdi Grimm.
Avdi, yeah, that's what you had said. I believe that's right. So Avdi Grimm, who's from Ruby Tapas and an awesome, prolific blogger and writer and tutorial creator, created this PDF called Exceptional Ruby. And the idea of this book is it's all about writing software with failure in mind. And we're going to be talking about a few things that might be a little bit Ruby specific, but overall, the arc of what we're talking about is building not just for the golden path, but even more so building systems with planned failure into them. So understanding what points may fail, how to recover failures, and what are some strategies with exceptions or failures in general. So I'm really excited to dig into some of this stuff. I've already implemented some of it into my code this week, which I'm really excited about. And I'd love to kind of talk through some of those examples and kind of jump in.
Yeah, so let's jump right in. Okay, so this is how the book starts. He says, in most test suites, happy path tests predominate, and there may only be a few token failure case tests. And most mature code bases are riddled with the telltale signs of hastily patched failure cases. Business logic that is interrupted again and again by nil checks and begin rescue end blocks. And I was like, oh man, that's so true. Like, because you really, I don't know, it's like such an easy thing to think about golden path and then think like, oh, here's an edge case. Oh, here's an edge case. And then like when things break, you're just like, oh, I'll throw in a nil check. I'll throw in a rescue. It'll be fine. But I think hopefully the purpose of this book is to like get you thinking about, you know, designing with failure and not just like having failure as an afterthought. I don't know. It's a very technical book, so we're going to have to like lean on each other on on understanding some of these concepts better.
Yeah, for sure. So kind of after explaining what the point of the book is, and the point, like we said, is to handle and keep in mind failures and how to deal with that. So then he kind of talks about first, like, what is a failure? What is an error? What is an exception? How do we classify these things, at least in Ruby? But I think this carries over for most languages. So I'm going to just power through this quick explanation of these different things. So an exception is the occurrence of an abnormal condition during the execution of a software element. So it's trying to do something and then something just doesn't make sense and it kind of throws up its hands and it goes, I don't really understand. So that's what an exception is. A failure is the inability of software element to satisfy its purpose. He talked a little bit about this idea of contract, and a failure is when software doesn't fulfill that contract. An error is the presence in the software of some element not satisfying its specification. And he ended that with, note that failures cause exceptions and in general are due to errors. I think for the most part of these conversations, we will use all three of those words interchangeably because in general, they all, one leads to another. So an exception leads to a failure, which defines what an error is. So and it depends on which way you kind of look and how those filter up and how you parse out the syntax there. But that's the general idea. What did you get out of that kind of definition?
I don't know. It just sort of made me think just about those terms because they're like different things, right? So I was thinking like, oh, this kind of makes sense because Ruby is like a dynamically typed language, right? So there's no like form of type checking. So I think like, I don't know, let's just try to come up with an example. So like an exception might be, okay, if you're a Ruby developer, you might see this a lot in your Rails applications when it's like undefined method blah of nil. And it's like, Oh, okay, clearly because this is a dynamic language, something thinks it's calling a method, but in reality, I'm passing a nil value and it's trying to call like nil dot, I don't know, nil dot first or something like that. Like pretend you're trying to get like, you expect that you're passing in an array. And so you're calling array dot first to get the first element. But for whatever reason, something happens and your program passes along a nil. And then your method is like, hey, what the heck? Like dot first is not a message that I could pass on nil. And so you see this like undefined method of nil class. And you're right. Like,
it says
man.
Undefined method first not found on nil is basically what that would look like.
Yeah.
And
exactly.
So that's the exception though. Exception would mm-hmm. be raised that says undefined method first on nil, right? Mm-hmm. So in that case though, where is the failure?
Okay, so the definition says the inability of a software element to satisfy its purpose. So maybe this feels like more of like a higher level thing. So maybe you're writing a movie ticketing software program thingy and dot first is calling like it's getting like the first in the queue, right? Or the last in the queue? I don't know. It's and this theoretical ticketing software is giving you like, I don't know, the next ticket for the movie to see if you're like if the movie's at capacity, right?
Right.
But for whatever reason your software is failing because somewhere down the line you didn't pass in this value of of remaining tickets. So your remaining tickets that's what's expected, right? Like I get remaining tickets, I called up first and it gives me the next ticket in the queue, but instead you got past nil. So a failure to me is more of a like a higher level, like what happened from like a business perspective, right? Like I wasn't able to get the next ticket in the queue.
So in your mind, failure is a breakdown of end user functionality.
I think so. I don't know. That's how sort of like I interpreted it. It's like, what was like the purpose of the method? Like what, I don't know. I think of things in terms of like the product, right? Like what business problem is this trying to solve? Or like what problem in general is this trying to solve? And I think like failure is the program not being able to satisfy the conditions in which it was given in order to solve that problem.
That makes sense. Yeah. And then so you're kind of saying that an error would be like not passing a full array to that method that's calling first, which would raise an exception, which basically constitutes a failure to the end user.
Yes. Very, very pedantic. But I think that makes sense.
Yeah. I think that makes sense too. And I think in general, the real things, I think they're kind of interchangeable because they're so closely related, but I think it's important to think about the way that a failure is introduced and the way that it bubbles up through the different classes and methods and controllers into your application and ultimately breaks down into the view, hopefully not, or, you know, gives a bad response on an API endpoint or no response on an API endpoint. And so it's important to think about the different layers of how this is kind of going up through that. And it's almost like a house of cards. And if you have one little card pulled out on the bottom, like the whole thing's going to collapse. And, you know, it's super shitty when a user sees a 500 error page, but it could be due to something nested way down in the logic that's bubbling up all the way through. And at some point, like, that exception will be thrown. And we're going to talk more about that as we go through this book, exactly how those failures and exceptions are passed in Ruby and what are some things we can do about it. So that's just kind of like what we're talking about when we mean failure, when we mean exception, when we mean error, as we're walking through these different things.
Totally. Before we get into specifics, maybe I'm putting you on the spot here, but like, what goes on in your head when, like, let's say you need to implement like the TalkBox API, right? Which is sure. like a WebRTC thing.
Yeah.
Which basically handles all of like the WebRTC internals. So you're like interfacing with some external API. What goes on in your head when you're implementing a feature like this and maybe the response that comes back isn't a 200? So like when you think about these things, are you thinking like, oh, I need to also account for the fact that maybe TalkBox might give me like a 500? And like, how do I surface that in my app? I don't know, maybe TalkBox is like a complex example, but even like the same goes for like Twilio, if I'm like, if you're interfacing
with like Stripe
Twilio.
Is one or that Stripe. A lot of people integrate with. Yeah, so I actually dealt with this the other day with Stripe, where the request from the end client was that every time a credit card is updated in the client's application, that whatever address information we have for that user is sent to Stripe so that their accountant can like see all the username's address, so like rich data against users in Stripe, because we were only passing emails. So in this case, I thought it was easy enough to just modify that payment update. We have this service object that integrates with Stripe and modifies that payment object. However, if the Stripe API, the way that it works is if the user doesn't have a details object against it, because it's like the address isn't just an address field on user, it's this details field, which has an address in it. It's very awkward how the Stripe API functions. But you straight up get a 500 if you try to pass an address to the details object when the details object hasn't been instantiated using the Stripe API. So all that to say is, did not design this well, did not plan on it erroring. And even worse, not only did the system throw a 500, but this is across like four or five different features of the application. Basically everywhere where Stripe integrated with our application ended up hard failing in production because I didn't take away this lesson and handle that 500. So there was kind of two mistakes that I made. A, I didn't anticipate or plan well enough in my test environment versus production, the way that Stripe is giving me data and needs data to be passed to it. But then B, I didn't even anticipate a potential error state from Stripe. So there's a lot of problems to kind of detangle in that and think through. And that's why I'm saying I actually used some of this week, because I was able to look at this 500 error and understand that, oh, this is exactly the types of things that we can apply from this book and start to learn how to handle those and write tests against it. So my first step, of course, was to write tests that replicated that error state. And then from there, start to build out the handling of those error states in the Stripe service object. That was a really long answer to your question. But in general, I don't think about it enough. And I'm excited for this book to start challenging me about thinking with integrating with external APIs and be more successful in those integrations and handling failures elegantly.
What does like a good first step look like in surfacing a nice, pretty error message to the user? Like, so let's say you get in a 500 from Stripe. How do you like explain that to your end users in a way that's like not weird?
I think this is really hard to do well. And I think what I try to do is write them to be as human as possible. Mm-hmm. And in some cases, even say, so, for example, Stripe will give you back a very technical response of something like detail does not exist for that user.
Yeah.
And so it's like that would mean nothing when someone's trying to update their credit card. And so in this case, I don't remember the exact error message, but it says something like, I'm so sorry. Something went wrong. We're on it. And so two things with that. The first is that I feel like a human message like that helps people feel like someone's working. And then second, like giving them some hope. But then with that integration, I made sure that this is flagged in AppSignal so that if we have these types of errors, especially when it comes to payment integrations, our team's notified really quickly and we can follow up with that specific user. And so, you know, the idea is that if they're seeing an error message like that, they're getting a response and we're flagging that in production and following up on it very quickly. The other thing that I will do sometimes is if I feel like the messages could be helpful from the API, I will actually label it as such. Maybe this error message will help and then display the vendor's error message. I'll try to word it in a way like that, knowing that it's not going to be really human readable and that it might help them get in the right direction. I tend to do that for administrative interfaces. So if I have an admin interface that's integrating with something, I had that set up for a Twilio integration that I did that sends SMSs. If you do an invalid number, you'll get the Twilio error that says, you know, invalid number or whatever error that it had sending the SMS. So it has both the very human readable message of, I'm sorry, couldn't send your message. And then it says, maybe this will help. And it passes through the kind of technical. But, you know, I feel like I use applications all the time that just give me the technical error. And it just is off-putting to users. It's not very helpful. And it's really hard to do right. I think in the best cases, you plan through those four or five different ways you can fail and write your own custom error messages kind of on top of or in place of what Stripe would give you. I think that's the best way to go about it.
Yeah, I think the worst thing you could do is like show 500, what is it, like internal server error or something like that. Like as a user, you're like, is this working? Like, did they even know that this could possibly be like something that breaks? So to put that in the context of the first chapter, which is like basically walking you through the life cycle of an exception, this would be like when you raise custom, like a custom error, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah. So do you find yourself like using raise with like custom exceptions that like raise us? Like, do you ever write like a, like your own custom errors that inherit from like, I don't know, runtime error or something like that?
I haven't done this yet. And it kind of recommended that you go that direction. I definitely use rescue with passing in a specific block to make sure that I'm rescuing that specific error. I've done that a couple times, and after this book, I'm definitely going to start doing that more, but I haven't actually, you know, inherited from a base error type and handled it that way.
Oh, interesting. But yeah, I same here. I think what I tend to do is like, we use Bugsnag at Open Listings, and so like it's very easy to just like send over something to Bugsnag and and then handle it that way. But I don't know, this is like making me think about like, what should you be doing when you raise an exception, and like, what do you put in the rescue? I don't know. I'm still kind of unsure of like what do you put in the rescue, basically?
Yeah, the main place that I've used them is in API integrations. It's really hard to get those kind of custom messages passed up back to the user's view in a rescue. It's just the way that they're structured. I haven't really found the best way of doing that. And so it's rare that I'm able to do that really elegantly. And so oftentimes, like if a method is running against something, it will pass true at the end if successful. So for example, sending a Twilio message. You know, this is a perfect example where in this case, I have a rescue. I have two or three different rescue cases if there's an issue with sending the Twilio message that catch the Twilio error, because I get back a Twilio error with a specific type. So there's rescue and then specific. Each of those not only send something over to AppSignal in the way that you guys integrate with Bugsnag, but as well, it returns false. So that in my controllers, I can say, if this doesn't equal true, then I can handle it on my controller side. But you know what I haven't gotten great at is passing the model level or service object level error messages back into my view. And that's why it's difficult to do. And I struggle with doing that well. And I'm hoping through this kind of book and deep dive into error handling, I'm able to get better at that and able to speak on that more eloquently soon.
Yeah, so you're talking about like perhaps surfacing to the user something in your like the notification alert thing that pops up that maybe says, I don't know, hey, sorry, something went wrong, we're working on it.
Yeah, or even more so, like I would love to be able to have my SMS service object pass the SMS errors that it had sending back to the view to the user. Okay. So for example, that phone number only had 3 digits instead of 11 digits or whatever is 10 digits is what would be required. But having the service object handle that instead of trying to push so hard on front end validations or writing that kind of validation-y logic in the view. Or, you know, ideally if Stripe couldn't connect, which is rare, but if Stripe was down, I would love it to return, I'm sorry, you can't update your credit card right now, can't connect, try again later, versus a hard error or just a something went wrong error. I would love that to be more nuanced and handled from the service object, because what I'm not doing with my exceptions or failures in Rails is handling them from the service objects or models that they're interacting with. Oftentimes those exceptions will return an exception, but then I'm actually kind of handling it more in the view than I am in the actual service object or model. I hope that makes sense.
Yeah, that's, oh man, that's very interesting. I think like, I think it's like an easy thing to think of error handling as like an afterthought, kind of in the way that when you first start out programming, you don't really think about testing. Like testing is also an afterthought. It's like advancing into the next level of, I don't know, being a good programmer is like, first you think about testing, and then obviously you only think about the happy path. And then you start thinking about like, oh, what about the reverse case? And then you start thinking about edge cases. And then you think about like, oh, what if this integration with this API doesn't work? Like, how am I going to handle this to the user? What I think is cool about thinking about exceptions and error handling is that it is very related to like the product and solving a business problem, because what you surface to the user oftentimes can like make or break their experience, and like where they are in the funnel, it can, I don't know, maybe they like drop off because you didn't like surface an error properly, or like it was like, oh, I don't know if the site's broken. Because I think what's cool about error handling is like, if the site is broken, you can make it seem like, hey, this is kind of like a normal thing that sometimes happens in random scenarios, but like, hey, everything's okay. Whereas like, if you kind of just throw like a weird 500 like server error thing, it's like, oh shit, like, did I break something? Like, is it something I did? Is it something they did?
Yeah.
It just is like overall, like not a good experience as a user who's like consuming any kind of product.
Yeah, for sure. I couldn't agree more. So let's talk a little bit about kind of the tools that this first chapter walks us through. So we kind of have these main methods within Ruby to handle these things. So we have rescue, which we've kind of already talked about a little bit. Mm-hmm. And we have ensure, which is something else that we talked about. And then we have raise. So we haven't talked about ensure yet, but we can talk about that in a second. So do you want to kind of walk us through what a rescue clause is, JP, and how you'd use one?
Oh man, when do you use rescue? Okay, so you would get into like a rescue block, like when an error is raised, right? So like, let's say this nil thing happens and you raise like the, I forget what it is, whatever error it is. And then so like—
no method error in that case.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So you can do like raise no method error. Yeah, right, because there's no method first on nil. The example we were talking about earlier. And yeah. So you would raise this error, and then you would get shot into a rescue block. And you could just like do whatever you want in this rescue block. I don't know, like what do you put? I'm a little lost here. Like not lost, but like I'm not sure what you would put in the rescue block. I guess like, I don't know. I really don't know.
Yeah, no, fair enough.
That, like, and so, for like that specific example, what could you put in a rescue block?
Yeah, so what you could put in a rescue block is a message sent to your error handling software, so you're aware that the error happened, and then a false. That's like most commonly what I put in a rescue block, because oftentimes a method that is being executed returns true. And so if I rescue it at false, I know that it hasn't been executed successfully in the model or view that I'm executing it. And this is why I struggle with this a bit, because, you know, passing and handling and appending those messages can be difficult at times. I have done it. I actually recently was doing it with form objects. I had a really complex form object that was interacting with 4 different models. And I put a rescue block. If it couldn't update all 4 models, then it would roll back those changes, return false, and return the message of which object it couldn't update. And it was a very, very edge casey thing, but I wanted to make sure that I planned for it. And basically it was the case of, It doesn't matter. I'm not going to go in. It was a super, super edge casey thing that I was handling that I couldn't handle validations for. And so it was like, after all the validations failed and all the standard ways, like, is there any way you could enter this really extreme awkward state? Well, I could think of one or two out of the thousands of different ways they could be. So I actually put a rescue there, and it rescues false and passes up those messages.
I wonder if this is how Rails works under the hood when you're trying to validate an object in memory. So like, let's say I have a user model and a user requires an email, a password, and a name. You know, you ever like hop into Rails console and you do like user.new. Let's say you only put in an email and a name, but you don't put a password. And then you like save that in memory, right? So you do like u equals user new, and then you like, oh, can I save this? And then you do like a u.valid question mark. And then sometimes it returns like true or false, but you can also do like u.errors.messages. In my mind, I don't know, if I was to like build that from scratch, that could maybe be a use case where rescue sends like not only false, but it like also appends something to like an errors object that has like password must be six characters or whatever. So like when you
So that's exactly what I did on this form object, is that in the rescue block, I appended the errors to the form object so they could be passed back to the redirect view. And so that's exactly how the way that I handled it. But you know, you're totally right. And that's a smart way to handle errors for validation. But the class of errors that exist on a model for validation is a different class of errors than the standard error class we're talking about, but it totally holds up in practice. And I think it's a great practice to actually add them to that class of errors if that's the kind of way that you're interacting with the object. It's rough though. I feel like it's tough to know, you know, because the hard thing I have is when integrating with external APIs, I feel like this is where a lot of this breaks down, because oftentimes those are wrapped in their own classes or service objects to manage those. And there may or may not be a direct interface, visual interface to that. Like there's no view necessarily to that interaction to the end user. And that's why it can be really hard to handle those errors sometimes. But anyway, all the way back to the idea of using rescue, we gave a great example of how to use it. I wanted to give a couple other tips and tricks about rescue. So on any type of rescue, you can pass it a block of what types of things it's rescuing for. So, you know, if your application, at least this is in Ruby, if your application blows up and you're seeing that there's a specific type of error message, you can just pass that as a block, and you can get pretty creative with those blocks of how they actually interpret those. But you also can have multiple rescue clauses for different types of errors. So if you want to handle three or four different types of error states, you can actually write rescues for each of those states. And the last thing I'll say is you can actually write, so let's move from rescue to ensure. And I've seen ensure classes here and there, like just in my Rails experience, but I've never written one, and I still haven't written one. But ensure classes will always be executed whether an exception is raised or not, which is really interesting. So if you need a specific block of code to always be run no matter what, whether it succeeds or fails, an ensure block code will always run, which is really interesting to me. I'm not sure a specific use case for that I would need, but it was a really interesting thing. It's like, I like to know all these tools that exist, because it's like, oh, one day I'll know exactly what that tool is for and use it. Like, I remember when I was a kid and my dad had one of those, it's called a oil wrench, and it's like this weird stick with a rubber band on it, and it's like specifically only for removing the oil filters off of cars. I never knew what that was, but the day I needed it, I knew exactly what it was, and it worked so well for the job.
Yeah, so to me, this is sort of like in JavaScript land, you have like a try catch, right? So you can try something, and then the rescue is kind of like the catch. But you can also call finally. So there's like try catch finally, and finally will always be, it's the same thing as ensure basically, except it's in JavaScript land. And I have sometimes used the finally clause when I wanted something to happen no matter what, which is basically what ensure is. So that doesn't really help you, but it kind of makes sense in JavaScript land, because let's say I want to try to do an API call, right? So let's say I have a mobile app and I want to hit some endpoint, okay? And if the endpoint fails, it's gonna go to catch. But because, you know, JavaScript land has so much state, I might still want to like advance the user to the next screen no matter what. So like, I have sometimes used the finally clause to maybe, for example, no matter what happens, whether or not this API response comes back like a 200, or if it comes back, I don't know, like a 404, 401 unauthorized or a 500, whether or not it fails or succeeds, I still want to like shovel the user to the next page. Now that's kind of like where I've used finally in a scenario like that. I don't know where I would use that in Ruby land. Maybe it's like where you set the state of something no matter what happens in like an API, external API call. I don't know.
Yeah, I think that makes sense. I want to read one quote from the book about rescue clauses. So here's a quote. In practice, the rescue clause should be a short sequences of simple instructions designed to bring the object back to a stable state and to either retry the operation or terminate with failure and pass that failure along. So that kind of sums up what the intention is regarding and kind of the best practice of how to use rescue. The one thing that I really want to try that sounds really interesting to me is this idea of a retryable error. Did you see mm-hmm. that section? That was super cool.
I have like a discussion point. Like, have you ever used retry? And like, I'm already thinking of like so many cases where it's like, oh, this unstable API we interface with, like we probably should retry that. I don't know.
Yeah, it's a super interesting idea. And so the idea is that so he wraps it in its own class, which seems like a really great way to do it, with a retryable error class inheriting from standard error, which makes a lot of sense. But even if you weren't to do that, you could kind of code this up where basically you pass an iterator loop and it's like, as long as this is less than 3 tries, continue to retry and within the rescue clause. And it's interesting to me how much it's just plain Ruby, you know, to be able to do something like that. And I don't think about errors in the same way that I do the rest of Ruby code or my Rails code. And it's challenging me to think about it more intelligently and use the same tools that I would use in writing other methods within my errors. Like, why not have a loop that's checking for a certain state and then interrupts that loop at the different state, whether it's successful or not. So that was just kind of like mind-boggling to me, because to me, rescue was like for this really simple, tiny thing. And in general, I think you should keep your rescue clauses pretty dumb. But this idea of retryable error kind of like broke the paradigm a little bit, that there's no, this is plain Ruby. You can do a lot within this clause if you need to totally return state to how you needed to be before.
Yeah, it's kind of cool. At the end of the day, it's like kind of just like a wrapper around like a while loop. And it gives you a nice API to like break out of the while loop if whatever thing succeeds instead of like failing, right? So like that's kind of cool that they wrap it around like just retry. Like you can just write retry if tries is less than 3 or something like that. And like as long as you increment the counter every time you try, you know.
Yeah, it's super cool. So I want to give a couple caveats on using some of this error handling and how you can kind of bite yourself, kind of like really hurt yourself. So one way is to rescue true and rescue without passing a block to it. So if you were to rescue true and rescue without passing a block, that means that the method will return as if it was executed. So let's say you had a method that was sending out an SMS and you rescued it true. That means even if there was an error with integrating with the SMS API, your system wouldn't know that SMS didn't send. And everything would return the state perfectly back to the user, but in reality, it actually never went out to the user and nothing actually happened. I have actually done this in the past in applications in my early days where I was not sure how to handle error states. And so I would do things like rescue true on a Stripe credit card update. And so, you know, it would return with card updated, but then within the form in the view, there's no card loaded. And so it's just like an even more confusing error for your users. But when you're trying to ship quickly, you don't understand what's going on under the hood, it's easy to do. And as well as if you don't really understand what you're implementing with a rescue clause, I think that would be easy to do, to have the state be passed in an invalid state without actually raising that error through the application. It's really important to think about how you're using them and make sure that you're passing that error state along and then it's actually handled, because you could just rescue it, just move along like nothing happened, but it's like, oh wait, no, this really didn't happen. And then the second thing is these really can affect performance. So if these are buried too much and you have too many rescues or insure blocks, and he gave a couple examples in the book, that it really can start impacting performance if that's a concern of yours, which I think in general, most of the scale we're dealing with, we don't really need to worry about that. But those were two big kind of gotchas that I wanted to talk about with rescue and insure blocks specifically.
Yeah. And also with like, when you're doing the retry, like make sure that it's not infinitely retrying these things. Like you need a way, you need to make sure that like, yeah, I don't know, that it only retries so many times.
Yeah, that's a great point. Because if you think about it, let's say, you know, using the SMS send thing, let's say you do a retry on the SMS send until you get a success message back. You know, if you even do three times there, you have to wait for three different trips over the wire on the internet and that API to respond. Your application's going to feel really unresponsive if you're too aggressive in how those retries are handled. So that's totally true. And of course, yeah, you don't want to get an infinite loop of retry, which you totally could do. Like, it's like, oh, well, I want this to succeed, so I'm going to have it retry until it succeeds. It's like, oof, that's probably not a good idea.
It's fine. Stripe will just like stop the API calls at some point.
Yeah, at some point they'll rate limit you, I think. Cool. So I'm excited to jump into the next sections of this kind of error handling and thinking outside of the golden path. That's kind of the way I see what we're digging into right now. Did you have any picks for us this week, JP?
I do, actually. My coworker told me about this podcast listening app called Overcast. It's just another venue for like listening to podcasts, but you have this option to basically speed things up. And what it does is it like looks at the audio and it sees where there are breaks based on like the sound wavelengths or something like that, and it like cuts those out. So you don't have all the natural pauses and all of the pauses. Not only that, but it lets you listen to podcasts at 3x speed. So it's like 3x speed on plus whatever optimizations they find in the like gaps of us talking, basically, or anyone talking, or whatever, wherever the audio things are peaking. And so like sometimes you'll see it'll say like 3.1x. So all that's to say is I listened to one of our podcasts in like 15 minutes and it was fucking awesome.
There's a couple apps that do that. It's such a cool idea because I don't know, for me personally, and if you're listening to us in 2x, more power to you. 3x, do it. Power through. I don't care at all. But for me personally, like when the language is so clipped, it's kind of hard for me to keep up and understand what it's blah, 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 blah. But that whole idea of removing the silences, I think that's kind of what they call it in Overcast, like strip silences, is really like gets it to be 1.5 or 2x, and it doesn't sound any different. It's just like when someone pauses like that, it'll just make it continue to run through, but it sounds really natural. It does a really, really good job. Overcast is one of the best. And one of my favorite parts about Overcast is it shows you your total time saved.
Yeah.
By using that feature. And it's like, surprisingly, when I was really using Overcast heavily, I remember it being like 2 days and I was like, holy hell. But I'm a pretty heavy podcast guy. I use Pocket Casts, which has a super similar feature, but Overcast is definitely, that's Marco Arment. He does really beautiful design and it's a fantastic app.
The one caveat is that one of my coworkers said it's not good for listening to like stand-up comedy because comedy relies so heavily on timing of things. And he was like, I listened to like a stand-up thing that cut out the silences and it totally ruined it.
That's so funny. Cool. My pick this week is a kind of odd one, but I have found it super helpful so many times. And, you know, PSA, some people might not know about it. So Apple.com, if you're buying a laptop or any kind of gear like that, they have actually a refurbished store that's direct from Apple. So it's totally different than doing like a Best Buy open box or like one of these other like weird Mac mall refurb sites. Like it's not that shit. It's direct from Apple. And like I saved like 30% on the new MacBook I bought versus the actual list price. It's the exact same model. But the best part about it is you're still eligible for the AppleCare, where if you buy refurbished or used anywhere else, you have no Apple Care or warranty of any kind. And if you buy Apple refurbished, you get the exact same warranty and you're just as eligible for Apple Care. So it's a super great route if you need to buy a new laptop direct from Apple, and you don't have to have like, you don't have to fake that you're a student. Like, there's no bullshit. And it's the only like actual discount that you can get on a real Apple product that isn't shitty. And it's because, I don't know, for me, when I'm buying like a $1,500 laptop, I just don't want to do that used. Like, there's some degree, like, I want to know that I can walk into an Apple store, they won't turn me away, they'll take care of me. And that's why it's just a great option if you need to buy a laptop. Just Apple refurbished. It's really hard to find. If you Google it, you'll find apple.com refurbished, or scroll like the bottom of the page and it says store refurbished. So that's my tip for the week.
Totally. Yeah. My personal laptop is refurbished. I would second that.
Cool. Well, thanks so much for listening, guys. We will see you next week.
All right. Peace out.